You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. It's just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up, and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot smaller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold, and all he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast about the week in sports narratives. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor here at 538. Across the table from me, the one, the only Kate Fagan. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Chad.
Kate, an ESPNW columnist and a recent ESPN The Magazine writer.
It's true. We're done some stuff for them before, but
okay. Well, since Hot Takedown,
this is a better one.
Yes, and we're going to talk about it later. I'm very excited. And then to my right, Neil Payne. Neil.
Hey, Chad.
Neil's a sports writer, 538.
But nothing in ESPN The Magazine recently.
Someday soon.
Yet.
Someday.
How you guys doing? You excited?
Yeah.
We're talking about Deflategate, guys.
I wanted to keep listening to Skip Bayless's rap, though.
Yeah, right. I could listen to that forever.
I think it's a great addition to the theme. So later in the show, we're going to have the finale of our months-long quest to fix the NBA lottery, and Jody's going to come and join us. It's so epic. We devoted two segments to it because we just couldn't contain it to one. And then, of course, Allison McCann will be here at the end to talk about to give us our significant digit. But first, if Hot Takedown was created for anything, it's to talk about inflated controversies like Deflategate. Last week, 243 pages of hot legalese dropped on the internet, and nearly as many conspiracy theories seemed to come to life within 15 minutes of reading at least the first 10 pages. And so, if you're listening to this podcast, I would assume that you know the basic gist of the Wells Report's findings. Some members of the Patriots staff deflated some footballs below the allowed limits. That it was, quote, more probable than not, end quote, that Tom Brady was, quote, at least generally aware, end quote, that the balls were being intentionally deflated, and that Patriots staffers text things like, quote, Tom must really be working your balls hard this week to one another in their off time. And so the NFL responded this week by fining the Patriots $1 million, taking a first and fourth round pick from them, and suspending Tom Brady, quarterback icon, for 4 games. And Channel 5 in Boston caught up with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh to get his take, and let's have a listen to what his honor says.
You giving up your season tickets?
No, why would I?
Florida, sir.
Absolutely not.
I can't wait till the fourth game of the season.
The fifth game when Tom Brady throws about 6 touchdown passes.
And because there were so many takes, let's do one more. This is from a Nesson roundup of reaction online. And just thank yourself that your job doesn't include having to read Donald Trump's tweets for a living.
Donald Trump might have been the angriest of them all, tweeting, "People are so jealous of Tom Brady and the Patriots, no court could convict based on the evidence. They can't beat him on the field, so this. They had no definitive proof against Tom Brady or hashtag Patriots. If Hillary doesn't have to produce emails, why should Tom? Very unfair."
Great point. Great point, Donald. So most of the hot takes seem to be about Brady. There were plenty, but let's isolate the Brady hot takes, especially what happens now that Brady's suspended for 4 games. And do you guys have any sense of what that's going to mean on the field for the Patriots?
Well, according to Las Vegas and the over-unders and just the early lines that have already been set now, even though it's May 12th, they have lines on some of the early season games. They downgraded the Patriots against the Steelers in their opener by 4 points. So it sort of implies that Brady is worth 4 points per game. And that they also downgraded the Patriots from 10.5 wins to 10 wins in the over-under win total for how much people are betting for them to win during the season. So it doesn't sound like that much. But then if you think about it, it's only a quarter of the season that they're without him. And they also don't know Jimmy Garoppolo. He looked decent against Kansas City in that game. Brady was pulled in early last season, but it's very much an unknown as to how much the Patriots will be hurt by this. And then there's that precedent of Matt Castle that everyone will point to of how well the Patriots did without Brady previously in 2008.
Right, and there's also the fact that Tom Brady had his job because he replaced somebody, Drew Bledsoe. Tom Brady's not going to be the guy who's going to sit back and take time off during these 4 weeks. He will be there preseason, I bet even these mini camps. But I think it's almost impossible to put numbers to what this will do for the Patriots in those four games because we don't know what Jimmy Garoppolo is all about. We don't know what kind of NFL quarterback he is. Because the Patriots are the Patriots and they tend to turn lemons into lemonade all the time, you think almost like this could be an opportunity for them to find out if this guy that they drafted, Jimmy Garoppolo, could succeed Tom Brady eventually. Not right now, but see how he plays in four games. Or if he plays well, do they spin him for a draft pick to pick up to make up for the one that was taken away from them? So I think there's so much gray area because we don't know what his replacement's like and what his, you know, that value of replacement will be.
Right, and the Patriots we've come to expect that everything that they touch turns to gold, because it sort of has over the last, 10, 15 years.
And so we should note that Brady is appealing the suspension, and so maybe some of the point differential has been that it's pricing in the fact that Brady maybe does end up playing.
Yeah, I think it
like
is.
That. Kate, to your point, you're right that we don't know what's going to take Brady's place, but we do know what happens when Brady leaves the field, or rather we can sort of game out in past seasons. And our colleague Ben Morris looked at what would happen if the Patriots lost just one more game in each of their seasons leading up in the past 12 or 14 years. And if you took away one win since 2001, they would have missed the playoffs two more times, and they would have lost a playoff bye twice, and possibly four times depending on how it shook out. However, in all of their Super Bowl runs, they wouldn't have had anything really affected, because when they win the Super Bowl, they're particularly good, so that one loss doesn't end up phasing them that much. Mm-hmm. But Neil, I know you did some research around whether the real cost to the Patriots here is Brady or if it's these draft picks that were taken away from them.
Right, the draft picks are almost the hidden cost of this because so much ink has been spilled about Brady, and he's the face of the franchise, reigning Super Bowl MVP. It makes sense when everyone thinks of the Patriots, they think of Tom Brady. But the draft picks, one was a first rounder in 2016, so next year's draft, and then the other one was a fourth rounder in 2017. Those picks, if you do a little, even a conservative estimate of where the Patriots would actually be picking within those rounds, the value of those picks and the ability to control those players for the first, 4 or 5 years of their career, if you look at approximate value, which is this measurement of all, across positions of player value, the cost in approximate value is many times what the cost of losing Brady for four games, so just a quarter of one season, is. So it could be that the hidden cost of this suspension is the future draft picks that the Patriots have lost.
And so that doesn't matter whether they were to pick an offensive lineman or a safety or whatever. Just the idea of a first round pick is worth several times more than four games of Brady, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, it could vary based on who they would pick or who is available, but the average player picked in, number 21 overall and then number 22 in the fourth round turns out to be, about I'd say somewhere like eight times as much as valuable as four games of Tom Brady if Brady played like he did the past few years.
And also, we're not even factoring into those numbers how particularly good the Patriots have been in drafts and leveraging picks and making sure that they get the most out of the draft. So, of course, though, when you're talking about this, it's like you have your Golden Boy, UGG-sponsored, famous superstar who has now, in some people's eyes, been tainted, or you've got like these sort of soulless draft picks over here, right? And only true Patriots fans are going to really, really dive into what those will mean for the franchise. And the one thing that I have been thinking about has been, because the Patriots are going to now see what they have with Garoppolo, I can almost see them getting some value out of that knowledge. I think that will be sort of the silver lining for them, is like, if he performs really, really well, then they have an asset that they had not been able to put on display before. that could come into play for them.
And the Patriots have a history of that also with, like, you think about Ryan Mallett. Like, everyone who was Brady's backup was almost presumed to be a pretty good player or, you know, a decent prospect that you could flip for a pick, even though they offered very little evidence outside of the preseason that they could do that.
What our colleague Ben Morris is always trying to figure out is whether or not the Patriots' success is because of Tom Brady or because of Bill Belichick. And this offers a small glimmer of insight into what happens when you disentangle the two of them. And you just look at this point now what Bill Belichick can do with a rookie quarterback. So another thing I want to talk about was what this is 4-game suspension means relative to NFL suspensions. We just got done with a season in which Ray Rice and Adrian Peterson had suspensions of varying length, seemingly by the month. I mean, Ray Rice started 2 games, then he was suspended indefinitely, then he appealed the suspension, now he's reinstated back in the league. I mean, it's all over the place. Adrian Peterson, a very similar thing happened where an appeal brought him back in. It seems as though, despite changing the personal conduct code that Goodell said he was going to rule by, we're still in this arbitrary space where any suspension can be any game, any number of games.
This is the question people keep trying to answer or ask is this a fair suspension? Or put this in context. And it's impossible to put this suspension in context at this point. The way I try and answer it is to say, okay, the NFL operates like a little mini nation state, except there's no checks and balances about how they go about their processes of like judicial and punishment. And so how can you label something fair when the process that got you there is changing day by day and it's not solid, it's blowing in the wind. This whole thing is a moving target right now.
Well, but there is a check and balance, which is the Players Association, when they come and appeal these suspensions. But what's tricky is that the NFL gets to control the narrative for a month or whatever it is. And so there isn't a check and balance before action happens. It's only reaction that the check and balance
comes. Yeah, the NFL owns the narrative for such a long time that then the NFL Players Association is almost handcuffed because they're trying to chip away at what's already been put out there and discussed for months. And I think people want to compare Tom Brady's 4 games to Ray Rice's initial 2 games, and those things are just incomparable. Like, the state of the NFL now has absolutely nothing to do with when Goodell handed down 2 games. And so to even compare that makes no sense, as well as comparing Tom Brady to Bountygate, because that was about violence and headhunting, which is a completely separate thing. So I just think maybe over the next 10 years, if the NFL shows some consistency in this stuff, we can look back and see what this punishment really looked like.
Right, and that's the point, is the total lack of consistency just between cases of similar types even. Like our colleague Allison McCann, who has done a lot of great work researching suspensions that the NFL has handed out, found that Brady's suspension was in line with a performance-enhancing drug offense. But then, you know, like going back to the old rules in a pre-Ray Rice era, domestic violence only got you suspended an average number of 1.5 games in the past. So it really is apples and oranges. And like you said, Kate, it's going to take some time to sort of contextualize this Brady suspension relative to other offenses that the league hands out.
And although the league has been somewhat transparent about the fact that some of this punishment is about Brady's and the Patriots' failure to cooperate during the investigation, like Brady being unwilling to give over his phone, and then the Patriots rejecting multiple interview requests with the guys who had handled the footballs, right? But they were transparent about that, but they didn't really give us a percentage breakdown of how many games for the actual deflating of footballs and how many for the quote-unquote cover-up. So we're still kind of left being like, well, was it 1 game for deflating and 3 for failure to cooperate, or was that reverse?
How many would they have gotten if they had cooperated fully from the very beginning?
So there's transparency there, but in terms of how to deconstruct it, you're still at a loss.
It seems, if I were to put my 538 hat on, which is not always on, but if I were to put it on now, it seems like this is a sample size issue, which is that our samples, it's unclear what the sample is, right, because of the conduct code changing definitions all the time. And then, to your point, Kate, like, we don't have enough granularity of data to understand like what the data points are that we can maybe base some assumptions or some insights on, and which ones we don't have to do that.
Right. If you're running a regression trying to predict number of games suspended based on various offenses that players committed, it would be really impossible to entangle the various, you know, weights given to each particular offense.
Impossible to entangle the weights.
And so sentence. Many people are saying now that maybe this was harsh because Goodell was only 13 months on the job during Spygate and didn't hand down the kind of punishment maybe now he wishes.
The lagging indicator of the Spygate thing. Or
and
something.
So then you've got also, how do you view this through history's lens?
Maybe it's a makeup call.
Right. Is it a makeup call? How much of this punishment is like residual from Spygate? There's just so many factors in this particular moment and in the relationships. And there is a relationship between this punishment and what happened with Ray Rice and Greg Hardy in terms of the NFL and Goodell now wanting to like have all of this control and to really bring the hammer down on any infraction, whether it's off the field or on the field.
So we have to move on to the NBA. So we're not going to have time to talk about the conspiracy theories about the Rouse report, but they are out there. And I just want to tell our listeners, for those of you who emailed after 538 ran a sort of dissection of the Wells report, I've read your emails. I think that you have put an amazing amount of effort into this thing, and you could be right. Like, it does seem to me like the more and more I read that there perhaps isn't being enough, there aren't enough holes being poked within, especially the statistical analysis of these pressure gauges, whatever. But what's interesting about this is there's such an obsession of detail about something so minute that, like, to get someone, a few outside experts to, like, read the 240 pages and whatever else is a real task. But wanted to tell our readers and listeners that that we were planning to talk but didn't have time to. So let's leave the Deflategate talk there, and we're going to switch gears to fixing the NBA lottery. But first, a word from our sponsor. Our sponsor this week is SeatGeek, the smartest way for fans to save money on sports tickets. You know the feeling, you're sitting there looking at all the other people in the stadium at the same game as you, and you're wondering, how much did that guy pay for his tickets? It's the kind of doubt that can gnaw at you. They have what is essentially the same seat as you do, but they may have gotten it for much less money. Kate Fagan, I think, got a seat for $10 less than I did.
Yeah.
Kate, how'd you get that deal?
SeatGeek.
Oh, wow. So SeatGeek can help with that. It helped with Kate. It harnesses all sorts of data to give you a range of ticket prices, aggregating tickets from every major ticket site online, and taking into account historical ticket prices, the day of the week, who the opponent is, etc. This week, you can use promo code TAKEDOWN on the SeatGeek app and get a $20 rebate off your first SeatGeek purchase. All you have to do is download the app, enter the promo code before you buy your tickets, and SeatGeek will then send you $20 once you've made your first purchase. That's promo code TAKEDOWN. The SeatGeek app is your ticket to sports this spring. Okay, we spent a month talking about the NBA lottery, how to fix it. Neil, this conversation started when you were on vacation. I know that must feel like so long ago.
Yeah.
The vacation part.
Just the vacation part. The lottery part feels like it's just starting, though, still.
Our Sherpa throughout has been Jody Avergan, our producer, who read thousands of your comments. Jody, welcome back to the show. Jody, how are you feeling after looking at that much text about the NBA lottery?
You know, I actually was able to take it in little morsels here and there and split it up, and I actually was just mostly, like, really impressed. I mean, there were 7,000 ideas, but I, like, all of them were thoughtful and interesting to read, and, you know, you start to notice themes, and you start to see, kind of, get a sense of what the average NBA average incredibly nerdy NBA watcher kind of cares about. So it was very heartening, actually, to read them all. My eyes did start to glaze over after about 6,500 or so. But, you know, just to recap for people who might be listening for the first time, we've been asking folks to submit their ideas in a crowdsource for how they would change the lottery system and prevent tanking in the NBA. And we're here now to run through some of the finalists, and we are going to pick a winner at the end of this process. I don't know if you guys are prepared for that. We'll see how contentious it gets.
I've got 7,000 words of notes to go with all the entries.
Exactly. And we are still committed to printing this out on fancy paper. We haven't figured out what stock yet, but we'll print it out on a fancy paper. We're going to notarize it. We're going to put it in an envelope, and we are going to send it overnight to Adam Silver's office. It will arrive in time for next week's lottery. And hopefully by this time next year, he will be adopting the official hot take. This Kate looks very skeptical. He will be adopting the official hot takedown plan to fix the NBA.
Great. I'm ready.
You guys are ready?
Yeah.
All right. So before we get into some of the specific plans, I feel like we kind of honed in on a few basic criteria about the plans. So one was that it had to be viable. The second was that it had to be easily understandable so that the average fan could sort of get their head around the new plan.
And some of these stretch that definition a little bit.
And the third is that even though we want it to be viable and understandable, it still has to be cool. So on that first criteria about it being viable, you know, we got a lot of plans for like Premier League style relegation. You know, the worst teams would just drop out entirely. And that's cool, and it's like obviously a very popular idea, but we just didn't think that it was something that was realistically potentially going to happen. I mean, I think the biggest implication there is that the D-League would just have to be a much bigger, more robust thing.
The market size would have to change a little bit, because right now already some of the teams are stretching the definition of what a big enough market is to support an NBA team, and if you brought a D-League team in,
and you just don't, I just don't see a situation in which owners would
There'd have to be antitrust legislation, I feel like, for this to happen.
So, but I just want to give a shout-out to Nick from Austin, if you're listening, because he did propose. He wrote, and we'll post it on the site, he wrote a really brilliant, compelling argument for relegation and taking into all these factors. But it just felt like a bridge too far in terms of actually being able to work. Same goes for full free agency, which a lot of people were behind, which was just get rid of the draft entirely and just let everyone become a full free agent.
All the incoming drafts.
Right. And again, we just don't think that's would go anywhere. The NBA draft is not going to disappear. I mean, I would like to live in a world where that exists, where people just get paid according to their market value. But
did anybody propose that although it would be free agency, teams would have more money for incoming rookies based on their...
I
think that was one of the twists that they had, was that the worst teams would have more fake dollars to spend,
rookie
or
cap
rookie
room.
Cap or something.
Okay. Yeah. At least if someone proposed it.
I think it was someone like that. Kate from New York?
It was Kate from Brooklyn.
Who knew? And then in terms of just sort of viable plans that are not viable, this is unfortunately the moment at which we have to say goodbye to the notion of Adam Silver riding a bear into a tank full of fish, each of those fish linked to a particular team, and whichever fish the bear eats first, that team gets the first pick. So pour one out for that plan from Bob in New Orleans, which was our favorite, and we discussed it a little last week. But
commissioned a artwork.
And we commissioned the best artwork the 538 has ever run, potentially. and actually, early runner for the Hot Takedown t-shirt. If we ever make t-shirts, I want to put that Adam Silver riding a bear on the shirt. So those are some of the ones that just kind of don't seem viable. That second criteria about easily understandable, there were a lot of really wonky plans in there that could be useful fixes, but just didn't feel like something that the general public could sort of get quickly. And then you know, we wanted something cool. And so some of the plans were maybe effective tweaks, but were maybe even a little too small bore. And actually, Nate Silver, our boss's plan, which is just sort of about closing the gap between the different percentages for the worst teams, feels not cool enough, not ambitious enough in a way. So plans like that we said goodbye to. So here we go. We ended up with what we narrowed down to four really great options, and we gave them names. So the first one we'll discuss is the tombstone date. Then we're going to talk about the lottery playoff. Then we're going to talk about the tweaked wheel. And then we're going to talk about the futures. And I'm going to present them to you, but you guys are the panel. You three will discuss and prod and probe and sort of figure out the pros and cons. And then at the end, we're going to pick one.
Okay.
Any questions before we get going here?
I feel good. I just want everyone to remember understandable, because I think I'm going to come back to that later on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, if it's not understandable, we'll get to understandable, but that might be on me if it's not understandable. All right. So, and some of these are also, I will say, like really long, some of these proposals. So I've pared them down here. I'm not going to read the full thing. Sometimes I've paraphrased, but we will post the full list of finalists as they were submitted to us on the site, and people can go and disagree with us and so forth. Okay. Here we go. First plan is the tombstone date.
Spooky.
Yeah, spooky. This is from Brett in Philadelphia, submitted this. And the gist is, as he puts it, I'm quoting Brett here, lottery balls would be determined by elimination wins. Elimination wins are victories that occur after a team has been officially eliminated from playoff contention. Tombstone Day, I love that, Tombstone Day. Tombstone Day is the day your team is eliminated from any possibility of making the playoffs. Whichever team gets the most wins after Tombstone Day gets the most lottery balls. So in 2015, this is how it would have shaken out. The Sixers were mathematically eliminated from playoff contention on March 19th. March 19th is their Tombstone Day. From March 19th on, the Sixers had two victories. The Magic were eliminated on March 25th, so after the Sixers. March 25th is their Tombstone Day, but they had three victories after that date. The Hornets were eliminated on April 10th. They had zero victories after that date because that was right towards the end of the season. Under this system, the Magic would have had the most lottery balls and thus the higher odds of winning the draft above the Hornets or the Sixers and so forth. What do you guys think?
I guess my main concern with this one is that we all agree tanking exists on a GM level, but the rosters and the players themselves aren't tanking. So what would change from the player and coaching perspective from when you're trying to get to Tombstone Day and then from Tombstone Day after? You're kind of assuming that you would tell the players, get to Tombstone Day, and then let's start playing well. But the GMs and players are already trying to play hard. I truly believe that. The players and coaches are trying to win games. So I love Tombstone Day, the premise. I'm worried about, in actuality, that there's not too much of a change there.
Right. Part of the elegance of it is that it gives you, you know, if you're really bad, it gives you more opportunities to theoretically win. You know, if you get eliminated mathematically in January, you have months and months and months to potentially try your hardest to win, whereas a team that gets eliminated in the last week of the season is a better team and more likely to win, but they only have a small window of time in which they can do it. So it sort of balances between the two, but you still have that problem of trying this race to the bottom to get to Tombstone Day quicker, and then at that point you have this team that wasn't good enough, you know, and like you said, Kate, the players are playing as hard as they possibly can, and the coaches are trying to win games, theoretically, so it's not clear how, once you get to that point, you can make your team better in order to compete and try to, you know, win as many as you can after Tombstone Day.
Let me flip this upside down. What if teams, GMs, constructed their rosters to hurry up and lose, then at the trading deadline or before the trading deadline, traded for better players so that they could hurry up, or so they could win by the end of the season after Tombstone Day, right? You lose your first 30 out of 40, whatever, and then you trade for better players, and then you're trying to get the number one pick by being good.
Right.
And it backloads the calendar.
Yeah, you would see almost like an inverted tanking scheme where you go – it certainly maintains fan interest late in the season, which I think is one of the bigger selling points of this proposal. But at the same time, you will see teams trying to get to Tombstone Day as quick as they possibly can. And so horrible early season basketball and then trying to become competitive later.
And we also even thought the Sixers were awful, and their Tombstone Day wasn't until, what, March 19th?
That's because these are – So
right, but right. What's the trading deadline? Right. You could tank as hard as you possibly could and still not make your roster better. I mean, you have to be epically bad to be eliminated from the playoffs in time for trading deadline.
Right. So I know that there were a number of submissions that sort of had this Tombstone Day idea, and a few of them did address the trading deadline and some changes that would have to take place there. But even with that, I think that this plan, and I kind of noticed a trend reading throughout all of these, that there seemed to be two kind of concerns about what tanking did. One was at the very bottom. What I kind of thought of going into this as the tanking, which is like the really bad teams trying to be really, really bad. But then I think I noticed a real concern for the mid-level teams and saying, you know what, if we're going to tweak this system, it should really be about making those mid-level teams have a path to getting really good. And this Tombstone thing kind of, you know, in this scenario, the Magic get rewarded, or even if you're one of these teams that tries to game the trading deadline, you trade for a bunch of good players. That's like an active move towards trying to get better. And in the end, you're sort of rewarding that, which I think a lot of people found refreshing. And I just also want to just point out what Neil said, which is I just love the notion of like the weird matchups and like fans getting like re-energized at the end of the season by watching two really lousy teams go at it and realizing that like everything's at stake by a, you know, a late season Sixers Knicks game. I could see people wearing t-shirts
and actually rooting for a win in those situations as opposed to now rooting
for
a loss.
Yeah, that I think is the most compelling part.
I just still think it would be tough if you did tank and then you traded for good players. What you let's say you trade for like Paul Pierce or something and another good player. Like, you think, I just can't see these guys also feeling good about being a part of that. You know, I mean, yes, they're going to play as hard as they can.
Whereas the Sixers players just feel wonderful.
but even bringing in guys as part of a Tombstone Day team, those guys are going to feel real bad about that.
All right, let's move on, but that is the coolest name, and I think it's going to be the coolest
name. Great sponsorship opportunity. Yeah, Tombstone's Pizza would be all over this.
You got to keep this stuff in mind. If we're going to sell silver on this, you know, that's something that that matters. Okay, next plan is the lottery playoff, and this is a plan that has been bandying about for a long time. A lot of people submitted, but we picked Chad from Champaign, Urbana, Illinois. Nice town. I've been to Champaign-Urbana. Chad from Champaign-Urbana submitted his lottery playoff, and I'm just going to read it here. He says, at the end of the season, all playoff teams get a week off to rest and game plan. During that week, the 14 lottery teams play a single elimination bracket tournament for draft picks. The two teams with the best record get byes into that. The winner of the tournament gets the first pick in the draft. Second place gets the second pick. The rest of the teams are slotted according to record and so forth. So, theoretically, according to Chad, every lottery team has a shot at the first pick, but if you lose a tournament game, it is in your best interest to have the most wins possible in order to be ranked higher than other teams. So there's an incentive there to be good during the season, and then obviously you have this single elimination tournament where everyone's just gunning for it. It would be in the week between the regular season and the playoffs, people would get very excited. Chad goes on to say, the pros, everyone has a chance. Imagine two teams playing for the next MJ in a single elimination tournament. Everyone would watch that. Chad concludes, he says, cons, none, you're welcome, end quote. I like his confidence, but what do you guys think?
Very humble about this proposal.
What do you think?
Somebody else go first, because I feel like I'm just going to like knock all of them
just be the
down.
Wet blanket on all these. So this is the entertaining as hell tournament, basically, that Bill Simmons came up with. And the thing I like about it is, in some ways, it's sort of geared against parity, because the team that wins this tournament is most likely going to be the best team to not make the playoffs. And so that team, almost you could make a case that those types of teams deserve franchise-changing, you know, Andrew Wiggins-type picks, more than a team like the Sixers, who have been deliberately, cynically awful by design. So you're going to have to maintain some level of quality to even be able to compete in this tournament and have a chance to win, unless there's some kind of handicapping system where the Sixers are given 10 points at the beginning of the game against the Phoenix Suns, and then so on and so forth. So I think in some ways it's anti-parity, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing compared to the way that the lottery system is right now, which is just totally trying to generate parity by gifting horrendous teams with talent.
This gets to what the draft is and the lottery is supposed to do in the first place, and that's something we talked about when we first talked about this a month ago, because to me this creates inequality and it stratifies the lower half of the league, because the best of that lower half is going to win the first or second pick more years than not. And what I didn't understand about Chad's write-up here is he says the rest of the teams, the ones that don't win or get second in the tournament, are slotted according to record, with the best teams getting higher picks. And I didn't know if higher there meant numbers three and on, or if higher meant the higher numbers.
Because, probably means higher numbers, okay. I would think.
How are you going to call out a fellow Chad like that?
Listen, we're a self-doubting crew.
Well, I think it means that the worst record can do no worse than third overall.
Okay, so I'm misreading that.
Which is sort of a safeguard against what I was talking about earlier where, but typically these drafts don't have more than, like, sometimes they have three life-changing talents in them, but a lot of times they only have one or two if they have any. So you're going to see the worst team in basketball not really, miss out on those types of players more often than not. And again, I wonder if that's really even a bad thing.
Okay. One, I worry that now it's incentivizing those middle-of-the-road teams to not make the playoffs.
Right, you're going to see losing to deliberately to tank out of the playoffs.
You're going to see tanking in the middle.
Because this year the Nets would have preferred to be
to win this playoff
right.
than to lose in the first round.
Right.
Two, I think we're overestimating the players are going to play to win, of course. But we're almost projecting onto these bad teams how the GMs and fans feel about getting draft picks as opposed to how the players themselves, the excitement level of this tournament, the players would feel about playing in this tournament. It would feel like a third place game, you know, at the World Cup to the players.
After playing 82 games.
Yes, to the players. I don't think you're going to escape that energy. I think fans and GMs think this will be the most exciting tournament ever. I don't think the players themselves are going to have the same sort of like desperate approach to this tournament as the GMs would hope they would have.
And they're also playing for the team to select their
replacement.
Better
player?
Yeah, exactly. They're playing to lose their own job.
You think they want the number one pick? More money.
Think about a future free agent to be, someone who's at the last year of their contract, they're going into the next year. They would fake an injury, just refuse to play. Why am I going to play 8 extra games to get a team that I know I'm leaving a really good pick? That to me seems like the biggest flaw here. Mm-hmm. But in terms of fans getting it, this is, I think, the number one proposal, right? I mean, everyone would get this. Everyone would be into it. The ratings would be fantastic.
Well, they are bad teams, though, fundamentally playing each other.
But it's still one. I feel like anytime you have one and done and there's like momentum towards like a big prize, it's going to
bring
fans are going to get
it. But the players themselves aren't motivated for the prize.
Well, maybe they are. Hold on. If I'm John Wall and Bradley Beal, right, and I want another great player. You want another great player.
Some teams would be.
I do think, though, it would have a totally weird psychological effect on the presumptive number one pick to watch 8 or however many teams it is compete for you. Like these pros are going to – your head's going to get even bigger than it would otherwise when you were number one.
How
big is your head now when you're like sitting there and you're watching an entire franchise like the Sixers or the Knicks lose as many games as possible over a 3-year period for you?
But they've constructed those losses well before
they'd be wearing t-shirts that say who they want.
Right.
They'd be their warm-ups.
Yeah, maybe. Okay. All right, so we're moving on from Chad's proposal there, the lottery playoff, our second one. And we're going to move to what's next? The tweaked wheel. But I want to throw you guys a little bit of a curveball because we just talked about the lottery playoff and we talked about the tombstone date. Well, as it happens, somewhere deep in our spreadsheet, someone had actually proposed a combo of these two. Todd from Byron, Minnesota, proposed a plan which is effectively tombstone date plus a lottery playoff. So let's just quickly go over this to see if, this helps with our skepticism thus far. So the way Todd lays it out is the 8th seed in the playoffs is determined by a single elimination tournament of the bottom 8 teams. So basically 7 teams get in and then there's an 8-team tournament to get that 8th seed. Then after that, the tombstone idea kicks in. Wins after you are eliminated from the regular playoffs, in this case, that would be the 7th seed. And the catch is, and I like this twist, is that wins during that playoff tournament count towards your tombstone date number. So there's like an even huger incentive there to win, to get into the playoffs. But if you fall one game short of getting into the playoffs, you've improved your sort of tombstone date number.
So the playoff then isn't for the lottery pick, it's to get into the playoff.
Yes.
Okay.
But over the course of trying to get into the playoffs, you're also helping your lottery chances.
So this takes place after the regular season ends.
Regular season ends. 7 teams have gotten in each conference. There's a 1-week single elimination playoff to get into that 8th seed. But then teams are also accruing Tombstone Day wins as they do that.
Hmm. Okay. So let's say it's the Nets and the Celtics in the final game of the play-in tournament to the playoffs.
Slash tombstone.
For the 8th seed of
the eighth seed of the playoffs.
In the playoffs.
Correct.
For just the Eastern Conference. There's a whole shadow tournament happening for the Western Conference.
Yep.
So
if starts at 11:45 p.m. Eastern.
So, but this doesn't get rid of the problem where the Nets still don't want to make the playoffs.
Yes,
right.
May even exacerbate it because they've increased their tombstone number mm-hmm. to get to that game, and then they are faced with this very stark choice of we win one game and we get to go play one random playoff series against the number one seed, or we lose this game and we are guaranteed the number one pick.
I think it puts coaches and GMs in a tough position because they'll be pulling guys.
Yeah.
They would want to pull guys and sit guys and come up with some reason why they can't play. I mean, that would start to happen in this scenario.
And I think this works better in a sport like hockey where things are more random anyway and you see the 8 seed pull upsets. Whereas here, the 8 seed wins so infrequently over the 1 seed in the first round of the playoffs that you're sort of running headlong into this kind of you can say you made the playoffs and you can tout that on next year's media guide and try to sell season tickets that way. But other than that, there's really no reason why you would want to not engineer it so that you could just flame out and, you know, like in the championship game and have your tombstone number be a certain amount but then not make the playoffs and get that number one overall pick.
I do have to say in reading through these, this was another theme that I noticed, that it seemed like when talking about these middle-of-the-road teams and these teams in the, like, 7 to 10 spot, that some people who were submitting ideas just kind of, like, took it as a given that making the playoffs is this huge thing that no team would ever pass up on. Mm-hmm. And some people were like Neil, maybe a little more cynical and realizing that, you know, there are going to be at least every once in a while some teams that make the calculus and say a really good pick is better than making the playoffs. But I noticed that thread throughout, and people sometimes sort of explicitly said, this is hinging on the fact that I assume that everyone wants to make the playoffs. That's like a really big deal.
That's a huge assumption.
Yeah, and making the playoffs is a pretty good golden ticket if you feel like if once you're in, anyone has a chance and anything can happen and you can go. And I think that's true in baseball, and that's definitely true in hockey. But I don't know if that's true in basketball.
What if you made the NBA playoffs single-game series so that there's more randomness injected into the playoffs? Then maybe it's better.
Right, that would incentivize you to make the playoffs more
because anything could happen.
Yeah.
The viable part of all
right.
this.
Right.
What if the winner of that just got to go play in next year's March Madness and just beat up on college teams?
I hear the Kentucky was better than the Sixers this year, according to Larry Brown.
That's for another show. Okay, so we've moved on. We are moving on now to our third official proposal, which is the tweaked wheel. So a lot of people had ideas about the wheel and some variations on the wheel. For people who don't know what the wheel is, Chad, do you want to take a crack at just describing that very, very efficiently?
Yeah, so the first time I read about this was in a Zach Lowe piece on Grantland. It must have been a year or two ago now. The basic idea is that the lottery basically becomes random. The draft becomes random. And where I, as let's say the Nets, draft is preordained. That there's 30 teams in the league, and every team for 30 years gets 1 through 30, but doesn't do it in that order. It's random in the order. And so I would be able to look as a Nets fan and see that in 2022, the Nets were picking 17th, because the year before, we picked 5th. And,
your picks
see what
for the
next
30 years are basically determined in advance in random order.
Right. I suppose that we could still trade draft picks, as why not? Let's say yes. But in general, the records are removed from the conversation.
Right. So you would end up with situations where, you know, the team that wins the NBA playoffs this year or wins the championship this year, their wheel number happens to be 1 next year. And so sometimes you'd end up with a really good team, end up with the first pick. But, you know, at least it's just kind of random and stable and everyone can sort of see in advance. So that's the wheel, which I think is, you know, in this world at least a semi-established notion. So, of course, we got sort of tweaks on the wheel and wrinkles on the wheel. So this is one that comes to us from Adam in Seattle, Washington, who said here's his proposal. He says, I propose a quote-unquote draft number, which would be calculated by adding a number generated by the wheel approach to a number representing the team's reverse ranking in the standings. For example, a team with a wheel value of 17 who finished 8th worst in the NBA standings would get a draft number of 17 plus 8. The lowest draft number would get the lowest pick. The second lowest number would get the second lowest pick, etc. And then ties would be broken by the team with the lower number in the wheel. So basically, it's the wheel, which is totally arbitrary and random and planned in advance, with a kind of where you finished adjustment to it according to how bad you were.
So I wish Adam would have talked to Brett, our Tombstone originator, because I think this idea works better if it has Tombstone wins attached to it.
You want a Tombstone wheel?
I want a Tombstone wheel. Absolutely. That would just roll away. Very strange Tombstone. But because to me, where you rank in your conference doesn't quite have the same thrill, because there are just too many other factors. If you're in a weak conference or a strong conference, to me, it should be about the quality of the team on top of this arbitrary random.
You know, we're going to get an email from someone who said, you know, I proposed the Tombstone wheel. Like someone,
it was
like
in
line
4297.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and this doesn't totally eliminate the idea of getting bad on purpose. It just sort of mitigates it a little bit by having this other aspect of it. So you're almost like regressing your own placement to the mean. And so no one, if you could be the worst team in basketball, but if you don't also have a really low wheel number attached to that, then you're going to be pulled back toward the middle of the lottery pack and so on and so forth. And then the wheel, really the main selling point of the wheel is the predictability and the regularity of it. And you'll have your ebbs and flows of, your draft position. And you know this originally in the one that Mike Zarin proposed, it was a 30-year time period, so every team knew that it would have a time in which it was picking first and a time in which it was picking last and everywhere in between, and every team was equally parceled out. This plan is going to be more weighted toward bad teams still, because in addition to that very regular wheel pattern, you
which
also
may not
have
be the worst thing.
No, yeah, certainly. Yeah. I mean, it comes down to what we're wanting out of a draft, and this sort of perfectly almost embodies it. Because the wheel is at one end of the spectrum where it's almost totally random and has that regularity to it. And then at the other end of the spectrum is about redistributing talent. And that would be if you arranged all of the picks according just straight up to worst record picks first. So this is a middle ground between the two. And it's sort of up to personal preference as to whether it accomplishes the best things of each of those two poles or the worst or maybe a combination of both.
It's also kind of boring.
Yeah, it's boring.
And there's math.
And I know it seems like simple math, but the mental gymnastics that a fan would have to go through throughout the year, it'd be like, so-and-so, the team we're playing has the fourth pick according to the wheel, but they're already really bad, so they might be trying to lose this game. And we have there are so many variables as you're going throughout an NBA season that the storylines are just fluctuating because of this.
You could maybe see, though, a spreadsheet adding a wheel number to each team's win-loss column or something.
Because fans love spreadsheets.
And nothing.
We'll do a shared Google Doc for every NBA fan.
Well, they can just check into 538 and check out the spreadsheet.
It would be a boom, that's what I love
about basketball.
The graphics ribbon around every single arena could list, like, in 2016, we're this wheel number, and in 2017, we're this.
It sounds like a dystopian YA novel.
So here's my biggest complaint about this, is that it forces teams, or rather, it doesn't force, it incentivizes teams to plan their championship windows according to perhaps where their tweaked wheel might be.
Because you know you're going to get wheels where it's like 3, 5,
right.
7, so because that's how math works.
And that's when you pick to be bad.
Right,
right.
And that's my point. This is my issue with the wheel in general, is that there's too much long-term planning. It's as if right now I knew every life event that's going to come up for me in the next 30 years and could plan when to take a big vacation or not based on when I might get laid off or not. And like that's just not how things should work. There should be a proactive and a reaction.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we're going to move on to our last proposal here, but I just want to say, I think we're being harsh. I mean, we should celebrate.
We're sending this to Adam Silver. This is an important moment.
Yeah, we're stress testing. That's
to make them stronger.
But I just want to remember that we should also celebrate.
Enjoy the moment.
The ingenuity and, these are some pretty smart ideas in here. And,
I would have had an idea to submit. So
exactly.
Absolutely.
All right. The last one is called the Futures Plan. And this was submitted by they call themselves the Futures Draft Planning Committee of Samuel and Cody here in New York City. They start the proposal with a Kanye West quote, which I got to I gotta love. The quote is, "I'm living in the future, so the present is my past. My presence is a present. Kiss my ass. Sam Hinkie."
Can we play that clip?
I'm living in the future, so the present is my past. My presence is a present, kiss my ass.
Sam Hinkie. And I don't know if that's a direct quote. I don't know if that Sam Hinkie part is in there, but that is from Kanye West Monster. Okay, in a nutshell, this is how they write. This I think is the highest upside if you get it plan out there. Neil is getting psyched here. Okay, in a nutshell, they write, teams tank because they own their own picks. We would eliminate tanking by creating a world in which nobody owned their own pick, but instead owned stock market style futures on other teams' placement. What that means in plain language is that you are picking on another team and banking and betting on how they will do the following year. So if I'm the Sixers and I'm a bad team, I don't get my own pick because of that. I don't get a pick because of that. I get to then say, you know what? I think the Magic are going to be the worst team next year. And my fate is tied to how bad the Magic are, not how bad I am. There's a lot of wrinkles in here, but let's dive in.
Okay. Can we do a little case study? Just because so I can better understand it, because I'm struggling with this one, guys. Okay. So this year, the Timberwolves are the worst team in the NBA. Let's assume that this plan had already existed for 5 years. Let's not worry about how it starts up. Because I think when I was reading this earlier, that's where I was getting caught.
There's some trickiness about how this sort of first turns on, but you know what? Adam Silver is a smart guy. Yeah, that's Adam's problem. Right.
So, okay. So the Timberwolves this year are the worst team.
Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. Because actually, the Rockets held the Timberwolves' futures. So the Rockets pick first.
If the Rockets were in a position to and the Timberwolves were on the board when everyone was picking their futures and sort of – so what happens is during each NBA draft, you make a pick for a player, and then at the same time, you make a pick for another team that you're going to tie your fate to next year.
So last year, the Rockets picked whenever the Rockets picked, 10th. And the Timberwolves were still on the board, and they said, we select with our 10th pick of the draft, whoever the Rockets selected last year, and also the Timberwolves' draft pick next year. Okay, now the Timberwolves finish worst this year, so the Rockets pick first, correct? Right? And they have first choice at the whole board. Correct?
Correct. Okay. So now this year the Rockets are picking first, and they can then say, okay, next year's season, the 2016 season, I think the Magic are going to be the worst team in the league, and we're going to tie our fate to the Magic.
So here's my insight, not sure if it's a critique or not, about this. It would make very clear who the best GMs were, perhaps. Because the GMs who sized up their competition the best perhaps could pick in the top five every year. There is a feedback loop in this that could be super dangerous and stratify the league within 5 years of it coming into play.
Right. There's no element of randomness to this after however you decide to sort of start the mechanism. Once the mechanism is going, in that Rockets example, the Rockets got that number one pick because of how they had picked, you know, whoever they had before. Say they had, you know, Cleveland 2 years ago, and so that earned them that 10th pick. But then, you know, if the T-Wolves were still on the board, then they were able to pick the T-Wolves. So it sort of builds upon itself continuously year after year. And yeah, it would really play into who had, you know, the best projection system or the best, you know, the shrewdest eye for who bad teams were going to be. And that's sort of the appeal of it, is it removes that randomness aspect. But is that really what we want out of a system like the draft, which theoretically, at least right now, is, and this is true across all the sports, I think fundamentally at their core, they're designed to redistribute talent, not to funnel talent to the shrewdest GMs.
I mean, I actually do like this idea. I think some of the language maybe is what I'm getting hung up on, because what I'm hearing is that it's almost like a, if you make a shot and you get the ball back, it's like,
yeah, it's like make it, take it.
Because you were right about Minnesota, and now because you're right about Minnesota, you get the first pick and you get to pick which team's going to be worst. Because and here it says the worst record gets to pick other teams' finishing positions, but that's not actually what happens.
That is a that's like kind of a twist that you could add on, and I think this is the big weakness of the system is determining who gets like what order of preference for next year's future. So you could do it by record, and then the Rockets would, if they somehow held the Timberwolves' future for this past season that happened, the Rockets would pick first, but then the Timberwolves would have first dibs at who they got to choose other than themselves. That's another important aspect of this is you can't pick yourself, so because then you would tank, especially if you had yourself in the draft. So you have to say as the Timberwolves, I think the Sixers are going to be bad. I'm taking the Sixers. But determining who gets that order of preference, I think, is the big kind of controversial point of the system.
You would need two separate drafts for this. You would need the drafts of the players.
Yeah, you have the player draft.
And then based on the team's records, the draft of who they're picking for the following year.
That's one possibility.
I think you would need to do that. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to get redistribute talent.
But you don't think that there's enough fluctuation with it year to year that like you could potentially, you know, pick some team to do, you know, like the Thunder. If you ended up with the Thunder and you're like, oh, we're screwed. You know, we were the last team to pick for futures and we ended up with the Thunder and they're really good. And then all of a sudden, you know, they're not that good because they're injured, and all of a sudden you end up with a good pick. So now there's like another team is sort of cycling. I don't think that it would be as stagnant as you guys think in that sort of bottom group.
The thing about this is we can't even use the current state of the league as sort of a template that we could say, oh, well, it's very obvious that the Sixers were going to be bad. Yeah, but that's because the Sixers had this intention to tank with the lottery system. It's pretty likely that the teams would become more and more compressed toward 41 and 41 each year, which is that what we wanted? Do we want to foster parity in that way? But then, like we said earlier, something that cuts against that is the picking skills of the GM. And you might have, like, if Pat Riley is just this uber genius at predicting who will be the worst team in basketball every year, he could theoretically run the table and just continually get those number one picks.
Neil, I can't believe this, but you're sort of selling me on it. A couple other concerns, insights, whatever you might want to call it.
Qualms.
Would the picking of the next year's futures, okay, so when Timberwolves pick the Magic, I think is the case that we're using, happen before the Magic pick their draft pick?
That's a great question.
Because in this case, then, it really matters if I trust the Magic GM to pick a good draft pick or not.
Pick a bad player just to spite the
team? No, not at all. But maybe I think the Magic GM is a dummy, and I think he's going to botch the sixth pick this year.
Then that's just another reason to pick them.
We also need to know if it's going to be public.
Right.
The drafting of the futures.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know who has you?
Because that's a lot of locker room material.
Right, that's the best part of this.
If it's public, if I'm the Magic and I go up there, I'm like, the Pelicans are going to be the worst. That's locker room material.
That's so good.
Or is it a grand reveal right before the draft?
Oh, high drama. I like that. But also, there's a player health concern that I have, which is that if I am the Rockets and I control the Timberwolves futures that year, I might ask Dwight Howard to really hack at Ricky Rubio to try and sabotage Rubio's
Let's assume
knee.
Decent human behavior.
Yeah, seriously.
Let's assume competitive behavior.
Well, then you could do that now, right? You could just go out in the playoffs and tell, let's say you're the Rockets, and you tell, Beverly to go after Westbrook. Like, no one would ever do that. but no, I mean, I think, you know, these aren't psychopaths. These are GMs.
But at the end of the day,
maybe I misspoke.
These are all the things that you're talking about, like the apocalyptic scenarios that when this is taken too far. They're at least taken too far in the direction of competition and trying to win. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the biggest selling point of all with this system is it completely divorces your draft status from the quality, either good or bad, of your own team. And therefore, there is zero incentive to tank.
But still allows for the quality of your intellect to have some effect on your play.
It's
right.
not
which
random.
Is sort of nice. Right.
To have a good scouting department and smart talent observers would be heavily rewarded.
Good
which
GMs
is good.
Are rewarded twice in a way,
yes,
right?
Which would be good. But you got to keep it silent so that the thing that Chad's talking about doesn't happen.
And the
so
other
that you don't know throughout the year
who
picked you.
How fun is that to know going into a game, these guys banked on us to leak.
It would leak, Kate. There's no way that it wouldn't leak.
No one believed in us, most specifically the Orlando Magic. But another thing is the NBA loves conspiracies. And so you could have conspiratorial situations where teams do tank for future, like if you if you made a favorable trade.
Daryl Morey and Sam Hinkie are sort of like handshake.
Right. Okay. So they actually, these guys who submitted this,
they accounted,
for a couple of these wrinkles. And we've been spending a long time on this plan, but they did say that you're not allowed to trade with a team that you had picked on, you know.
That affects which team I might pick in the first place.
And then there are non-complete compete clauses for GMs. So, like, a GM couldn't make a secret deal to go to another team the next year and then knowing that in advance.
So you make them bad, you take Wiggins, and then you go to the team that you just secured.
Just made bad. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So one of the things I really like about this plan is that it's like, at the exact same moment, the most complicated one we have and the most simplistic, because as you were saying it, Neil, it just completely removes your record from your pick. And it's just like, when you put it that way, it's just like clean and simple.
It's not that simple.
Right.
Though.
It's simple when you have a podcast to explain it to you for 20 minutes.
Sure. So you know.
You would need somebody very sharp to write that language around it.
Right. That's true.
Because Silver, sharp guy.
That's right.
Okay. So to recap, we have 4 different plans and 1 sort of combo plan, which I think we kind of just like shot down, so we may not even, but we have the tombstone date, the lottery playoff, then we have the tombstone date plus lottery playoff, the tweaked wheel, and the futures. How do we do this? How did they do this in 12 Angry Men? Did they just
lock us in a room until we?
We are locked in a room. Are we going to have? Are we going to lobby one another to do it?
I mean, I don't know. Does everyone want to just kind of say where they're leaning right now? Maybe we can get this over with and end this podcast in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Kate,
I would vote for the futures.
Interesting.
Wow, we have a convert.
I know where Neil's. Oh, I was going to have some suspense, Neil. Yeah.
There's no suspense judging by how we just talked about all of these.
Yeah. But, okay, so let me just ask this question.
Let's tease
this. Let's say we bring the futures to Adam Silver, right? Do we care whether or not our proposed solution has any shot of really. Because what I like about the futures is it's not part of the conversation yet that at least I know of, where the wheel is. Mm-hmm. And Tombstone, I guess, isn't, but, you know, maybe
entertaining
it's not
as hell
rad-
tournament.
Right, is already. And so what I like about the futures is that we could perhaps bring something new to the NBA that maybe hadn't already been discussed. We being, of course, the futures planning, draft planning
and
committee.
And Kanye West.
And assuming that Adam Silver just, like, opens every piece of mail that shows up in his office.
So that's what I like about the futures most. I'm concerned about the ramifications. But that is sort of the fun of it, maybe, which is that you would be able to see how people exploited the different advantages.
Every single one of these plans, I think, is going to have some jockeying.
If there was a perfect plan, the NBA would already have it.
Well, okay. I don't know about that, but
it's unanimous, the futures.
Really?
It's unanimous.
It's that simple.
It wasn't simple. It's very complicated, right? And we got to a good place together.
So, okay. Well, there we go. We have a winner. What are their names again? We have a winner. Samuel and Cody, the Futures Planning Committee, we are going to print this out. And I think Neil and I may get together and sort of streamline this language just a little bit to make it, you know, more silver-proof. But essentially, Samuel, Cody, we're going to print out your plan for the futures, put it on fancy paper, get it. Do we know if there's a notary in the office?
It become certified.
We'll have to send an all staff. Okay. We've got to get certified to become a notary. We got it now. Okay. We will print this out. We will put it in the mail, and we are going to send it to Adam Silver and hope, I don't know, maybe we'll get a response. We'll extend a formal invitation for him to come on this podcast and hear us out.
But tell us why it can't work
seriously.
Or can't work.
Yeah.
And take us seriously. But no, I agree with Chad that, like, this is a plan that when I first read it made my brain, you know, kind of like get excited, you know, and some of the other plans are a little too wishy-washy and some of the other plans I'd heard before. And I think the whole point of this project was to just like see if there were any great, weird, but actually kind of maybe doable ideas out there. And I think we found one.
Nice job, Jody.
Well done.
It was all worth reading all 7,000.
It was worth reading all 7,000. All right. Well, thank you, everyone who submitted, and we will post the full list of the finalists on the site so you can read them and you can tell us why you think we were wrong or why we should have picked yours. But thank you again to everyone who participated in 538, or Hot Takedown's first ever crowdsource. And now we got to – what are we going to fix next?
This is just FIFA. The gateway to
government.
Fixing everything.
Ooh, okay. All right, yeah. Redistricting is next.
Okay. All right, so thanks, Jody. And let's bring in Allison McCann to give us our significant digit and take this show home. Allison, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What is the significant digit this week?
So this week's significant digit is an especially important one, and it actually comes to us from Kate, who last week wrote an incredible story about Madison Halloran, who was a 19-year-old runner at the University of Pennsylvania who died by suicide last year. The digit is third, according to the most recent data compiled by the NCAA. Suicide was the third leading cause of death among student athletes from 2004 to 2008 after accidents and cardiac causes. And I think what's so important about this topic is not only understanding, you know, mental health and the stigmas that surround that, but also how this uniquely affects student athletes. There was an excellent piece in the Wall Street Journal in December following the death of the Ohio State football player Costa Kara George. And I think that she described this tension really well. And the reason the topic has received a little attention until now is that student athletes suffer lower than average rates of depression than other mental health diseases compared with students of the same age. But when those afflictions strike, the athlete often faces peculiar challenges, a sports culture that praises stoicism, a perception that athletes' lives are supposed to be charmed, and a sense that athletes' valuable is tied to performance. And I think Kate can speak a little bit more about that, but I think those were some of the things that Madison definitely struggled with, especially on her social media accounts, and sort of feeling like she had to craft this persona that wasn't how she was actually feeling.
I mean, there were a lot of interesting threads to her story. One was, as a college freshman student athlete, and Allison, maybe you can speak to this. I know my experience at the University of Colorado, I struggled that first year because sports, no matter how dedicated you are in high school, it turns into something very different in college, and it often then can start feeling like a job. And of course, because of the competition level being raised, it can be hard to perform at the level you're used to, not to mention like the life-changing event of changing your surroundings and leaving home is often a trigger for a change in mental health, or for someone who maybe has depression genetically in their family, that could be a trigger. So there was that piece to this story, and then there was the piece of social media and young people. And for those of us who maybe were slightly old enough that, like, we were on AOL when we were in high school, but we didn't really live online, young people, especially on Instagram, are just consuming so much of everybody's edited lives. And how, of course, that did not cause Madison's suicide, but it, to me, was sort of a metaphor for, one, how did that affect her? And also, how does the filters we put on pictures translate also to the filters we sort of force on people who are struggling with their mental health to put on themselves because we're not willing to talk about mental health enough? So those were a lot of the strings. And I think, of course, the avenue of like a student athlete and it being a sports story allows us to tell the story through Madison of these issues of mental health and these issues of young people and social media and perfectionism and all these different like storylines that I tried to weave in for that piece.
What was interesting to me, where is the space for vulnerability within sport in general? Pro sport, college sport, whatnot. And what was interesting about the Instagram example as a metaphor was that within social media, we don't really leave much room for vulnerability either. That there's an incentive to promote a certain filtered view of someone's life because you're going to get more hearts or likes or whatever, that if something's uplifting, then if someone is feeling down, or you're not going to post at all when you're feeling down. And within sport, sport is about strength. No matter whether if it's a male or female sport, if it's an Olympic sport versus a team sport, it just seems like sports are the way we talk about sports prizes strength and sometimes grace or sometimes agility or whatever other word, and there isn't a lot of room to allow for weakness to manifest itself on the field or the court, and as a result, or the track, And as a result, there isn't space for us to talk about how weakness might be manifesting off of it.
And one of the things I thought of when I was looking at this, just about, you know, there's research that shows that Major League Baseball players, when they change to a city that's considered, you know, with a rabid fan base and high pressure, that they really do tend to play worse in the first season there. So that's for people who are like grown, you know, adults who have done this professionally for many years. Even they have trouble adjusting to a new situation and their performance suffers. So why wouldn't we expect that from teenagers who are leaving home for the first time and going into a new situation where there's a lot of pressure on them to perform? And then also, like you guys were saying, there's so few support mechanisms for them. And there's this perception that everyone else around her was doing well. All of her high school teammates and, you know, all of her friends were doing so well because of these kind of manufactured images that were being put out there, that she sort of internalized it and felt like, oh, well, I'm all alone in this sort of, I'm not, you know, running as well as I used to, and I'm not, you know, I'm not happy where I am, and I'm the only one who's feeling that way, when in fact every single person who was generating these manufactured images also felt the exact same thing. And if she had just known that, I feel like that would have had a marked impact on her, you know, willingness to kind of push through the problems.
And one thing the family is trying to get past now is what they would call the Madison-Hollerin law, which one would require colleges, and this does not exist now, to list the suicide numbers on their campus, as well as to have qualified suicide prevention counselors on their campus. So that's important, and it's also important in Madison's story, like, it does translate to college sports, because we put so much time and resources into the human body in college sports, and all these strength and conditioning coaches that are paid, and these facilities, and there is so few resources being offered for the mental health of student athletes, and that deals with depression, yes, but also just the day-to-day mental health of a student athlete, maybe that doesn't suffer from depression as well. It's not something that we even are moving towards in the college game at as rapid a pace as you would hope. And another thing that I didn't write in the article, but that I learned, was that when you're 19, I think it's 19 to 22, is when your frontal lobe gets fully developed. And until that point, you often make more spontaneous decisions. So there need to be even stronger barriers in place to know that knowledge and to have the right people in place for young people, especially when they're making these dramatic changes in terms of going away to college.
Allison, you played varsity soccer at Stanford. Was there a culture of psychological help that if you wanted to seek it out, or if players wanted to seek it out, they could find it within the department? Or
yeah, I mean, I remember that there being nothing that was particularly geared just towards student athletes, but the general counseling that was available to all students that was great. You know, you could see anyone at any time and drop in and stuff. But yeah, I mean, I would totally agree that, like, you know, after practice every day, you just, you know, you went to the trainer, or you took an ice bath, and you, like, those things were routine. And, like, I don't know, like, thinking about how you were feeling is not, like, part of that routine and part of that process. And, like, maybe once every couple months or so, we would have, like, a, you know, sports psychologist or someone pop in. But
yeah, I do think that this story, you can have all kinds of conversations off of it about colleges and even athletic departments and how they're handling this stuff. But at the core of it, right, this was someone who had depression and did not feel like she could say that she was not okay. And I think that is the main key, because there's millions of people around the country who feel a similar thing, who are struggling but don't know that people care or think they're burdening people. And that's the barrier that we need to try to knock down, is to let people know.
And so, again, you can read Kate's, and I don't just say this because I sit across the table from Kate once a week, but it really is a sensational piece about Madison-Hollerin, and you can read it. We'll post it on 538 at the show page, and also at ESPN the magazine as well. Thanks, Allison, for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So that'll do it for this week's show. Our producer is Jody Avergan. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're also on iTunes. You can subscribe, if this is your first time listening, at itunes.com/538. Leave a rating or review at iTunes. It really helps others discover the program. Thanks, as always, to Kate Fagan. Thanks to Kate.
Thanks, Chad.
Neil.
Thank you, Chad.
I'm Chad Matlin. Talk to you next time.